John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
Adam Jude covered the Huskies, but now he's over covering the Seahawks, and so kind of an interesting switch. But before we get to him, Adam Jude joins us on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. Before we get to the Seahawks, I don't know, big game coming up against Oregon. Oregon comes in with a great defense, a great quarterback. They rank 12th. Huskies rank 25th. I don't know. What do you see, Adam, as far as happening in that game?
Yeah, I think it's a really fun matchup. It's kind of weird. We've been talking all week about Oregon's defense, which when you think about the Oregon Ducks, you certainly don't think of defense, at least historically. So they've been one of the best in the country. The Huskies have had their issues on offense. They had the breakout last week, very late down in Tucson in the win at Arizona. So can they keep it going against, you know, a really good Oregon defense? I think it's a fun matchup, and it's fun that it's an afternoon, traditional afternoon kickoff at Husky Stadium. You know, there's going to be a sprinkling of Oregon fans in there, but I expect Husky Stadium to be packed full of purple and gold, and I think it'll be a really fun, exciting environment.
Oh, no question about it. Can you see with the home field advantage the Huskies winning?
I can. You know, they're going to have to run the ball, which, you know, has been tough against that Oregon defense, and the Huskies have been really inconsistent in that regard, too. So, obviously, they need Jacob Eason to step up and make some big throws, but I think first and foremost, the Huskies are going to have to figure out a way to kind of keep the ball away from Oregon's quarterback, Justin Herbert, and really establish the ground game.
No doubt. All right, let's switch over to the Seahawks. And, you know, 5-1, I mean, winning a lot of close games. And, you know, I thought that it was interesting in the we talked to Tedrick Thompson, and Tedrick Thompson was talking about how they've already, you know, even though it seems like they're more bend but don't break this year with yards allowed in the key situations, they're able to make the key stops. And what Ken Norton Jr. told the team is pretty much is like they're comfortable in uncomfortable situations, which kind of explains how they've been able to, you know, bounce back when they give up yards, but they don't give them as many points.
Yeah, and who wouldn't be comfortable with Russell Wilson as your quarterback, right? He's just been so good. But, you know, certainly credit to the defense, too. They've been kind of a work in progress in some areas, obviously without Jaron Reed here for the first six games and, you know, trying to introduce, you know, Jadeveon Clowney and Ziggy Ansah on the edges there as well. And certainly with what they're doing with, you know, keeping their base defense on the field with those three great linebackers is, you know, kind of a really unique in today's NFL game. But, you know, they've made it work, and obviously they've kept the games close and kept it close enough where, you know, you give Russell Wilson the ball in the fourth quarter and good things are going to happen for this team.
Yeah, he's among the tied right now with three fourth-quarter comebacks in his five wins, and he's been one of the best that's coming into the league since 2012. Because, you know, coming from college and that and covering that, I mean, you watch the RPOs, you watch the different type of offenses. Right now, where do you see the Seahawks and things that they're doing to try to match up and stop some of the creative offensive things that have come out of college, particularly with the guys, you know, you watched in Baker Mayfield and, you know, other quarterbacks, Kyler Murray and that?
Well, like I said, it's just been really interesting to see them, you know, stick with their base defense and keeping those three linebackers on the field virtually the entire time. We in college football, you know, the trend, and look no further than the Washington Huskies here, but the trend has been to, you know, go, you know, heavy on your defensive backs, and no one's been better in that regard than Jimmy Lake and the Huskies, and really developing those defensive backs and pushing those guys in the NFL. But you know, you kind of get that speed on the field, but obviously, in general, you're sacrificing some size as well. But, Pete Carroll and Ken Norton, they're not willing to sacrifice anything. You know, you've got Michael Kendricks and KJ Wright on the edges, and of course, Bobby Wagner covering everything too. And, you know, they're able to match up against not only the tight ends, but maybe some of those slot receivers as well. And they're getting really creative in some of their zone coverages. And I think they've done a pretty good job. Like you said, it's kind of a traditional bend, but don't break. Obviously, they want to keep the ball in front of them. Their big thing has always been, you know, don't let the explosive plays, don't let the ball over the top or the deep plays. And for the most part, you know, they've done that. A couple of slip ups there in the season opener against Cincinnati. But other than that, I think they've been pretty solid. And we'll find out what that means against Lamar Jackson on Sunday. It's a really unique challenge. Obviously, a guy who's as explosive, as exciting as anyone in the NFL, maybe more exciting than anyone in the NFL right now. And I'm really curious to see what kind of plan the Seahawks have to try to slow him down, because he's been so good right now.
What did you see how they matched up against Kyler Murray and matched up against Baker Mayfield, and even to a certain degree Andy Dalton, because Andy, you know, kind of went with some RPO type offense stuff.
Yeah, that's true, and they're going to see more of that too in the RPO read option type stuff. I think Lamar's going to do it even more. So, it'll be really interesting to see if they go a little bit more in the nickel package, try to get some more speed on the field. My hunch is, they'll stick with what they do. Good coaches are also stubborn coaches, and I've seen that at Pete Carroll certainly already, and Ken Norton Jr. as well. So, that to me is maybe the most intriguing part of this matchup, just to see personnel-wise what the Seahawks are going to do defensively to match up there. And obviously they want Lamar Jackson to sort of stay in the pocket and make him more of a traditional pocket passer and try to beat them with his arm. That's everyone's game plan going against Lamar Jackson right now. It's certainly easier said than done. And to me, that's what the game is going to boil down to. Obviously, Russell Wilson, the other side of the field, is going to work his magic. But can the Seahawks defense, keep the game close enough and keep things close for Russell Wilson to try to pull out another close win in the fourth quarter?
How do you look at the way that Russell Wilson has played? How's he amazed you?
Yeah, it's been fun. Again, as you said, it's my first year sort of being up close. Obviously, I've paid attention, the last 8 years in Russell Wilson's career, but it's my first time sort of being up close with him. Actually, I did cover, him at college at the Rose Bowl, his last college game when he was with Wisconsin playing Oregon in the Rose Bowl that year. Really controversial finish when he tried to spike the ball in the final seconds and the refs didn't give him the time, and Wisconsin took a tough, close loss there. But, this is the best Russell Wilson has ever been, right? That's objectively, statistically, there's no other way to put it. And he's just in such command. He never seems to panic. He always seems to, even when there's not an option there or an easy option there, he always seems to find a way to make the right play, even if it's to throw it away. Those rare times he's throwing it away. And what I've been impressed with more, we saw in those first couple weeks where, historically he's obviously waited till the fourth quarter typically to tuck the ball and run and pick up some key first downs in that regard. But I feel like the last few weeks he's done it a little bit earlier too. And obviously if you're a defense, that's hell. That makes it all the more difficult to try to defend him, just like Lamar Jackson. If Russell Wilson is going to run at any time of the game too, makes it a huge advantage for the Seahawks.
How impressive have you been with Chris Carson, particularly the way he bounced back after the three games with the fumbles?
Yeah, that's been the biggest thing, right? That's all we talked about, 3 or 4 weeks ago, was what's wrong with Chris Carson and can he kind of get over this? It just felt like the yips, right? Mm-hmm. You hear that in other sports, whether it's a golfer lining up for a putt on the green, or Chuck Knoblauch with the Yankees way back when, you just couldn't make the throw from second base, and it just kind of felt like the yips, and it's more of a mental block than anything. And I was more encouraged or more impressed with the way sort of Pete Carroll and everyone else around the Seahawks sort of handled that too. And I never wavered in their support for Chris Carson, and you see why now. He's one of the best running backs in the NFL, three straight games, over 100 yards. What a career high, 124 last week in Cleveland. And I think he has a chance to be just the third running back in Seahawks history behind Sean Alexander and some guy named Marshawn Lynch to run four straight games of 100 yards here. So he's going great. And for all the talk about Russell Wilson and certainly all that's deserved, we can't forget about Chris Carson and how important he is to this offense right now.
No, no doubt. It's going to be interesting to see also, how everything's going to be with if they're going to be blitzing. Because what I'm wondering, because as much as the Ravens blitz, what you can probably see is that is this going to be a mirror of the Pittsburgh game, where they're going to go out and try to, pass the ball a little bit earlier and try to get the get pass on first down as opposed to not pass on first down?
Yeah, that's interesting too. I was actually looking up some of those numbers last night and curious where the Seahawks ranked in that regard. Obviously, I heard about that all offseason. We've heard about it the last couple of years. That faction of Seahawks fan base obviously wanting to put the ball more in Russell Wilson's hands and air it out a little bit like so many teams are doing in the NFL. And they have done that a little bit on first down. I think they were running the ball about, upwards of 40% of the time or more, 49%, I believe. Last year, it's down quite a bit so far this year, and it's worked. Obviously, they're kind of forcing the defenses to back up a little bit, and again, as the game wears on, that gives Chris Carson a little more room to breathe as well, and the Seahawks are confident and comfortable that they can win the game, either by running it or passing it or doing a little bit of both, and obviously that's when an offense is at its peak.
Great stuff, Adam Jude. To read him on the Seattle Times, and thank you for joining us on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline.
Appreciate you having me, John. Thanks.
All right. Coming back next, we're going to get the grade book out and try to put some grades on with the report card. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time for the report card with the professor.
The report card, we get to look at the good, the bad, the ugly, the smart, the stupid, what people say, what people do. We take anecdotes, stories, items that might be published someplace, goofy things that people do. We'll attach a grade to it, and helping us out is Taylor Jacobs. And so, Taylor, bad things happened last night. I mean, you saw at the game, Patrick Mahomes. I mean, how bad is that for the National Football League if he's going to miss more than 3 weeks? It looks like right now the prognosis is probably 3 weeks, but how sad is that?
Really sad, especially sad because my dad is the biggest Chiefs fan. He's from Kansas City, so he texted me last night just all stressed out about it. He's like, I saw him walking. He's walking. He can't be hurt. He can't be that hurt. It's just not a good thing. Patrick Mahomes is such an exciting star, and Curtis put it such a great way that he's actually one of the great human beings in the NFL, and it's great to celebrate a guy like that, and you just see just the impact he's already had on the league, the fans, the next generation of fans. It's just really cool to see that all in motion with one guy, and it's easy to root for him even when he's not in town. Just a sad thing to see Patrick Mahomes out. Even for 3 weeks, it's just going to be kind of sad to see that Kansas City.
But I tell you what, I mean, I have to give a whole F right now to the AFC because that conference is as bad as I've ever seen.
Yeah, you did that video last week about the AFC, John, and it was pretty much just, it's about Patriots and Chiefs, then, then everyone else is kind of in a pack, and now it's kind of just the Patriots and everyone else until Patrick Mahomes gets back. So it's going to be really interesting to see sort of what happens, what cream will rise to the top in the AFC.
Let's put it this way. What cream it is going to be curdled.
Yes, I would agree with you.
Yeah. So let's go, Curtis, with what we have on the report card.
Well, let's take it to baseball. We all know the Washington Nationals are the National League champions in 2019, but they did it without one key guy of their last, playoff teams. That's Bryce Harper. And in an interview today with Jason Stark, about the Nationals making it to the World Series, Bryce Harper, with this quote, says, I think it's about being able to be the person that I am and not saying to myself, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm not a National, or oh my gosh, those guys are doing what they're doing, I can't believe it, I'm so jealous. No, I'm so happy for them. You know how hard it is to get to the postseason and win games. For them to be able to put together this year the way they have, it's an amazing thing. I've made my decision, and this was my decision. How are we grading Bryce Harper's handling of a situation where if he's with this Nationals team, they're a better team with him, but he decided to ultimately go and get his $330 million pay?
Yeah, I'm going to give him a B+. And the reason is that, okay, he handled it well. He spoke well about it. That criticism is, it's like, hey, you get rid of Harper, and it's like, we can go to the World Series. And nobody thought that. I mean, you saw how bad they were at midseason and how they had to kind of get hot in the second half of the season to be able to make it. But no, I give him a lot of credit for being good about it, and I'll give the Nationals a lot of credit for being able to survive without him.
I'll agree with you, John. I'll give him a B+ as well, and also because he had that mishap where he misspoke in his introduction and said DC will go to the World Series, and then he quickly changed it to Philadelphia. I'm so sorry, Philadelphia. And well, I guess he was right. DC ended up going to the World Series.
Strange bit of foresight he had.
I know. Yes, really strange, but also kind of fun.
So, I'm going to give Bryce Harper a B for that answer. I mean, he's handling it the best way he can, right? Like, what else can you do in this situation other than kind of tip your cap and say, yeah, they made it, I didn't, but $330 million, not a bad consolation to missing out on the World
Series. Be warm at night, that's for sure.
For sure. Also in the Major League Baseball postseason, we got a bit of espionage, I guess you could say, going on between the Astros and the Yankees. The Yankees organization alleging that the Astros are using a whistling technique to sort of steal signs, Astros manager A.J. Hinch was asked about it. Here was his response.
You know, Major League Baseball does a lot to ensure the fairness of the game. There's people everywhere. If you go through the dugouts and the clubhouses and the hallways, there's like so many people around that, that are doing this. And then, you know, when I get contacted about some questions about whistling, it made me laugh. Because it's ridiculous. And had I known that, that it would take something like that to set off the Yankees or any other team, we would have practiced it in spring training. And we would have got, you know, because it's you know, it apparently works when it doesn't happen.
Now, if the Astros are using this whistling technique, it's working wonders right now.
Oh, yeah,
because
no
they're
doubt.
they're up 3-1 on the Yankees and probably going to eliminate them tonight with Verlander going against James Paxton. How are we grading his response to the allegations of whistling being used as sign stealing?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm going to give him a C because it's like, okay, he's claiming it didn't happen, but it's like, you know, he's thinking through, it's like, yeah, maybe if we get this together in spring training and figure out how this works, maybe we can try it. I mean, I don't think they're doing it, so I can't give him a bad grade, but I'm going to give him one right in the middle.
Yeah, this is super strange. Look, tipping pitches isn't something new, and the way that other teams have been analyzing those tips and things like that. But whistling in the playoffs, it just feels weird and not right. But also, could they be tipping pitches and stealing signs? I don't know. Like, those things are beyond me in baseball. Yeah, I'm just going to give it the whole situation a C. And then there was something about, like, banging on pipes, that there was also stuff like that.
Yeah, that was very bizarre. In baseball, if you're not cheating, you're not trying, as we all know.
Right.
John, in your years covering the NFL, what were some of the crazier stories you heard about teams trying to steal signals from the opposing sideline?
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, it obviously goes to New England, you know, with Spygate. I mean, because, you know, what they had was a guy taking pictures of how the plays were coming in, and then what they would do is that they would take it to the coaches at halftime, and so then the coaches then would get word up to Ernie Adams, and Ernie Adams, once he would see something, would, you know, get down in the and yell down so they would be able to get a blitz going if necessary, or, you know, get something to Tom Brady that he can use. And so that was probably the weird things about it is that I still remember a couple teams that knew that was going on, and so what they did is that they would hire the guy that would, you know, break signals and stuff like that, because again, they would also try to, you know, get the communications devices out and get the things going where you can get the plays in after the 15-second mark. So they hired the guy who trained him and have him stand on the sideline staring upstairs saying, if you do it, I know how you got it. And of course, that was always the one. Spygate was one of the all-time greats.
For sure. I mean, there were many layers to Spygate.
Oh, yeah.
And we're still hearing stories about it years after, like how deep it truly went.
Yep.
I mean, there were, I think in college football a couple of years ago, I forget what team it was. I think it may have been like ASU under Todd Graham. They were stealing signs. And so teams in the Pac-12 would hold up bed sheets to hide the coaches from, like, you know, their hand signals and whatnot, so that ASU could not see what was being called into the game.
Crazy stuff. It's just wild that, especially in football, it's got to be much more difficult. I know in baseball you have pitches and certain, you know, shifts and things like that, but in football it feels like sometimes you have dummy coverages, you know, you have linebackers cheating up to the line of scrimmage then dropping back into coverage. It almost feels like there's way more risk to do it in football than there is in baseball.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot more cameras on you in football as
right.
Well.
Yeah, strange.
That's it for the grade book today, John.
Okay, you can check out the show in the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Coming up next, we are going to take your text questions at 710-710. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On demand with the 710 Seattle Sports app.
Well, it's time to start to take your text questions. Text away at 710-710. And so, C. Raj, what do we got?
From the 253, they say, hey, John and Curtis, for Sunday, how do you see the weather making an impact? Will it benefit either team?
You know, I got to take a look at the hand size of Lamar Jackson because, you know, when you have weather conditions, I mean, you have more of a tendency to maybe have a fumble or two, you know, because the ball's going to be wet and all that stuff. I mean, I hope that Chris Carson gets the right cleats because I still remember he started the one game and he struggled, you know, getting his footing right because the cleats didn't seem to go and all that stuff. So, yeah, it'll affect Baltimore more than Seattle because, I mean, Seattle's used to it. I mean, I've been out there for every game and I've been soaked because it's rained every single game. So it's like, you know, that's not the case for Baltimore. So it'll affect them a little bit more. But you know, what you worry about is just, you know, the fumbles and things like that because of loose balls.
Lamar Jackson's hand size 9.5 inches.
That's a concern because, I mean, you know, you got what, 10 and a quarter for Russell Wilson. And so he's got that big hand to be able to grab the ball and not lose it.
From the 406, they want to know, Professor, did you collect sports cards as a kid?
I did. I did collect sports cards. In fact, I still have some of those sports cards. In fact, one of the few fights that I had in junior high in Grand Braddock, PA, was when one bully tried to rip up my Jim Pagliaroni baseball card, and I just went berserk, and I was banging his head against the wall.
Well deserved for that guy.
Oh, I mean, it was a great catcher, and it's like it was a big blue sky type of card and all that stuff. Yeah, collected football cards, baseball cards, you name it.
Nice, nice. From the 360, it says, Professor, I know you don't care about uniforms, but what would you think of the Mariners going back to their royal blue and gold color scheme?
I don't like it. I mean, it's like, I don't want change. Keep the uniforms as they are. I mean, I don't care about them anyways, but no, I don't like the idea. Why is everybody so worried about the uniforms? I mean, get the players in the uniforms and make it work that way.
From the, let's go with the 509, after last night's disaster of a game for Denver, who's in deeper trouble, Vic Fangio or John Elway?
Well, I mean, right now people are calling for Elway, not Fangio. I mean, it's not a good start. I mean, the one thing at least Fangio was able to do after about, 6 weeks, you know, their defense was ranking in the top 10, so he was making an impact there. But, you know, I still don't see any change. I hope there isn't any change. But right now the pressure is more going to be on Elway than it's going to be on Fangio.
From the 509, they want to know, John, with Lamar Jackson's scrambling ability, will that benefit the Seahawks pass rush more as they look to get more sacks?
It may hurt it a little bit, as we've seen, because you know now he can escape and you know maybe get to the line of scrimmage. I mean, you can have him trapped back there and he can escape. So, but I think the big thing is, you know, what you have to see is almost like the Andy Dalton game to start the season. I mean, you get him moving and of course you know, get him to a point where you know he may scramble, he may get yards, but he also can make some mistakes and get some interceptions and turnovers. That's why turnovers are going to be such a bigger part of this game.
425 wants to know, John, we're 11 days away from the NFL trade deadline. Who do you think is the biggest name that will be moved by then?
I still don't buy the AJ Green one. You know, I still wonder, is an Eli Manning going to be involved in a trade? I think the biggest name still is going to be Trent Williams, because as bad as this season has gone for the Washington Redskins, I mean, you know, are they really going to take a position? It's like, okay, we're going to keep a guy that doesn't want to be here, and at least we can get some value for him. I mean, trade him to Cleveland. Trade him to a team that needs a left tackle. I think that would better serve them.
From the 206, they want to know, has Atlanta's Super Bowl hangover been the worst you have ever seen?
No, I've seen worse. I mean, I think Carolina's was one of the worst I've ever seen. You know, because you know, what did they go 15-1 with an easy schedule, and then they come back and what did they go, like 7-9 or 7-8-1? I mean, that was just an incredible drop. So that was one of the worst ones I've seen. And then through the years, I mean, you've seen some real bad ones too. I mean, I think I go back to maybe Atlanta when Chris Chandler was a quarterback. I mean, that was a bad one. So no, there's bad drops and there's bad drops.
From the 206, they want to know, John, is Mike Tomlin safe in Pittsburgh?
I think so, yeah, because, again, they gave him the contract extension, but there's no guarantee. You know, and that's the thing that's, I think, even scarier right now in the NFL. You have so many coaches that right now are on the hot seat, and clearly he's on the hot seat. And right now, I mean, he's trying to, you know, get through and make it with Mason Rudolph and Duck Delvin and all that stuff. And so it's like it's pretty crazy. But, yeah, I guess he's on on the hot seat. I do know that there is interest by Washington in trying to get him.
Keep your eye out for that one.
Yeah.
From the 509, they want to know, John, what's Patrick Peterson's future in Arizona?
I think that, in fact, I know that I was on in Phoenix today, and right after I came on, Steve Keim usually comes on, and he said they are not trading him. So his future is going to be maybe getting a contract extension with Arizona.
From the 425, they want to know, is Jeff Fisher done as a head coach at any level?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think he's still young enough to be able to get back into coaching. I know he still wants to coach and all that. So you never rule him out. But, I mean, the problem is in the National Football League, you know, they don't go now for defensive coaches for the most part. They want offensive coaches. And so that limits his chance of getting something.
From the 425, they want to know, who do you see having a better week this week, Sam Darnold, Matt Stafford, or Gardner Minshew?
Sam Darnold, Matthew Stafford. I'm going to go with Matthew Stafford. I just think that, you know, he's been doing well with Daryl Bevel. I'm going to go with Stafford because, again, you know, Minshew kind of got gobbled up last week by New Orleans. And so I'm going to go with Stafford.
From the 206, they want to know, Jaron Reed, he comes back this Sunday. How much impact do you see him having on the game?
I think he'll get things started as far as getting this team back with the pass rush, because now you think about, okay, you've got Clowney playing at a Pro Bowl level. I mean, you've got Quentin Jefferson having a career year. I mean, Ziggy Ansah, they've got to make sure that he plays. But you put him, you know, you put Jefferson and you know, Reed together, I think it's going to make a good impact.
Ooh, good question here from the 360. They want to know, where is Sam Bradford and whatever happened to him?
Pretty much, it's not like he retired, but the league kind of retired him. You know, he's had the injuries and all that stuff, the lack of success, the bad record, and nobody seems to be interested. So I wouldn't say that he's retired, but I think the league probably retired him.
We talked yesterday about Brock Osweiler, how much money he made in his career.
Yeah.
Sam Bradford, you tackle one on the end of or on the start of what Brock Osweiler made. That's about the ballpark where Sammy Bradford was in his career.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
go well.
Hat tip to his agent for working out all those huge contracts that he got.
From
the 253, they want to know, will Von Miller be a Bronco this time next year?
Yes. Yeah, because, I mean, that's the one guy you can't trade. And that's like even what Steve Keim was saying. He says you don't trade because, again, like, for example, it's hard to find, like in the case of Patrick Peterson, a top cornerback like that. And it says it's also hard to find a top pass rusher like a Von Miller. And, you know, you're trading away, you know, a Hall of Fame player. Patrick could make it. I mean, Miller is going to make it. No, he's an institution. You cannot trade him.
And finally, from the 425, they want to know, John, who is your favorite superhero?
I would lean toward Superman. I mean, it's just—I mean, maybe it's old school and stuff like that. I mean, you know, Spider-Man's good, but we see too many Spider-Man movies.
Yeah, right? I mean, I feel bad for his uncle getting killed in every single one of those. It's okay, we get it, like. Move on now. I'm going to go Captain America. Captain America and I, we share a last name, Rogers.
Oh, I was going to say, I didn't know your last name was America.
Yeah. I see what you did there,
Joe.
There
you go. Okay. Hey, you can check out the show in the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealers. So coming back, our daily dose of the Groz coming up next.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And joining us for the Daily Dose of the Groz is Dave Grosby on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. And so, Dave, last night, I mean, I just thought it was sickening to see what was going on with Patrick Mahomes. I guess the good news is Adam Schefter reporting early prognosis on his dislocated knee is that it may be okay. He may be back as early as 3 weeks. But to take a player as great as that and have him hurt and you worry that he might not be able to come back this season, I just thought that was almost devastating.
Devastating for them, but it's not going to be that. It's not. Look, John, the NFL is packed with young stars, and this is not to take light of Patrick Mahomes' injury. It was sad, but it's a devastating thing for the Chiefs. I don't see it as being anything more than that. And it's just watching this great career go on. You want to see him go on unimpinged, and just to have it happen on such a bizarre play is wild too, because it didn't look like, you know. I mean, you can, when it's a hit, that's one thing, but when it's not really a hit, it's another thing. But yeah, I saw the same stories that you did. It sounds like This is similar to what Matt Stafford had, where he came back after 3 or 4 weeks. So he'll be back, and I'm considering this kind of karmic payback for the Tyreek Hill situation in Kansas City, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but boy, I tell you what, it's like, wow, that was scary to see him go down, and I just hope that he does come back.
But the league right now is bigger than any one player by a mile. I mean, where the NBA is kind of built around players, the league has done their job in building around the quote-unquote shield and the weekly games. And, you know, it was interesting watching inside the NFL how many great young quarterbacks are coming up now. And this is not taking anything away from Mahomes, but, you know, we're going to see one of them here this weekend. So the NFL is still in good shape. And for the Chiefs, we'll see how they respond. If they were just a one-man gang or not, they looked pretty good last night, although Denver was not very impressive, that's for sure.
Oh, boy. I mean, people are going like crazy right now wanting John Elway out of there. And, of course, they've got a situation where they're having a battle for who owns the team and the family and all that stuff. And so, you know, he's there as the constant. But right now, it's just not working.
It's not. It worked for a while there when he had Peyton Manning playing. And wouldn't it be ironic if Peyton Manning winds up replacing him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, that's what people are calling for. I mean, our buddy Mark Sloreth, you know, called him out. You know, called out, John Elway, thinking you say time to move him to the bench.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, it's obviously up for them to describe, but we can now focus on a big weekend here, John. Boy, we got a huge college game and a huge pro game. I mean, this Ravens Seahawks game is getting a lot of national attention for a lot of good reasons. It's really fascinating to me how the Ravens have managed to. In basically one-off season, you know, he played half the year last year, but a one-off season have built this hybrid offense around Lamar Jackson, who's right now, as we speak, on pace to do something that no one's even come close to, I don't think, in the NFL. I don't know if Michael Vick threw for 4,000 yards the year he ran for 1,000, but that's what Jackson's on pace to do. He threw for over 200 and ran for over 150 last week. They put together this offense around him. I mean, it seems like it's high risk because he seems to be a guy who likes contact to a degree, but it's something new, and it's a fascinating. I'm really looking at this game and seeing a potential repeat of the game with the Texans when Deshaun Watson and Russell Wilson had their shootout. I don't think the Ravens defensively, even though they got Marcus Peters, of course, a couple days ago, are built to stop the Seahawks, and the Seahawks are going to run the ball and try and control the ball. And conversely, I think the Seahawks are going to have a lot of problems with the Ravens on offense. So I think it's going to be a really entertaining shootout. And then, of course, you got Washington and Oregon. You know, John, in the last 17 years, you know how many times these teams have played within a field goal of each other?
How many?
Once.
Wow.
But it was last year, and they were tied after the first quarter, tied after the second quarter, tied after the third quarter, tied after the fourth quarter, and Oregon won the game in overtime. This is going to be a completely different matchup, I think, because Oregon is about defense, 100%. Their pass defense is maybe the best in college football. They haven't given up many touchdowns at all this year. Washington's going to have to figure out a way to run the ball effectively. And if they're going to win, even though it's at home, it's going to be a low-scoring game. So I see a really high-scoring game on Sunday and a real low-scoring game on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be the case. And don't you think in some ways low-scoring games favor the Huskies?
They usually favor the home team, and I would think that's normally the case, but this is not your father's Oregon Ducks. I mean, they are a team that is built on defense, and they've been benefiting from holding teams down. So usually, yeah, I would think that would be the case, but I'm not so sure that's the case against a team like Oregon that has such a good defense, because they've just not given up many touchdowns at all this year. Now, they haven't played Murderer's Row, fair enough, but they played some Pac-12 games, and they've given up one or two touchdowns all year, so this is one of those days where the defense, this is really the awesome defense, at least on paper, is on the other side of the field.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. How amazed are you that Oregon comes in with a great defense? Because that's just not Oregon-like.
It's changed. I mean, it's Crystal Ball has changed the culture down there, and it's where they've got their best players right now, and they're running the football as well. So it's going to take some getting used to, but I expect a really low-scoring defensive game. And those are fun, too, in this era of high-flying. But there'll be plenty of high-flying Sunday at CenturyLink.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. The challenge of these RPO quarterbacks, I mean, again, everybody is rightfully so, you know, critical of the lack of pass rush here. It is 6 weeks into the season. They only have 10 sacks. Sure. And last week, they didn't even get a hit. I mean, at least they got hits as far as when he ran, but they didn't get any pressures enough on. They got pressures, but they didn't get enough, knockdowns and things like that. And they've got to start getting that going.
They do, and I mean, this is going to be a tough week to do it because of how well Jackson runs the football. I mean, you know, the thing that's going to help, the other item that I thought was going to be helpful for the Seahawks in this one is the fact that Baltimore loves to blitz, and Russell Wilson owns the blitz. So, I mean, we'll see if they blitz him as much as they've blitzed everyone else. But from the Seahawks standpoint, I mean, you know, you want your defensive ends, your new shiny toys, to be the big factor in the pass rush, but they've got to play contained this week. I mean, they've got to be very, very careful about what Jackson can do running the football. We know that he's an elite runner at that point. So I don't know if this is going to be the best week for we'll see, but it's going to be a very tough week, I'll put it that way, for the pass rush to establish itself when you've got a guy who runs it as much as Jackson does.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. I mean, this is one that you know is not going to be pretty. The yards may be crazy as far as, you know, what they're able to gain. But, you know, I still thought there was a great quote when talking to Tedrick Thompson today. And, you know, what he's talking about is what Ken Norton did. It says, the one thing that's been great about this defense, they may give up yards, but in the key moments on the fourth downs, the third downs, goal line, you name it, they make the key plays. And what Ken Norton Jr. preached to the team is that this team is comfortable in uncomfortable situations.
That's a nice line. And bend but don't break has been a philosophy that a lot of teams have adopted over the years. And as long as you can do it, as long as you don't break, it can be very effective. And it's been the way the Seahawks have been. I mean, that's how you get to 5-1. It's by not making mistakes and by making big plays. And they've done that. They've done that really effectively. And this, like I say, I really kind of see a shootout in this game, but I don't think the Ravens have got enough to knock off the Seahawks. And I think this will be hard fought. I don't see a blot or anything like that, but I see a lot of points scored both ways and both defenses having a long day. And who knows, maybe Earl Thomas has a big player, too, along the way.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, that's going to be the great thing of, you know, him trying to read Russell Wilson and Russell Wilson trying to read him and try to put him in a position where he can make a mistake.
Yeah, what do you think?
Because the one thing that, I mean, he did it here and he's done it there is that he'll gamble on some things because, I mean, he'll make a read and he may go against the game plan and try to do it and be caught out of position. And that's one. And, you know, it does look as though he's lost a little bit. Not, I mean, he still has speed,
yeah.
But I mean, as you would expect for somebody now in his early 30s, he's not going to be doesn't have the range that he had when he was here.
I think the real question is what you brought up is how much did he pick up in practice on Russell Wilson and on, you know, if that's in fact is an advantage for him, or it's an advantage for Russell for throwing against Earl in practice. I mean, that's the great chess match of this. And you're right. Earl will take chances every now and then. And Russell's got to bite his tongue and not take chances, but he has been very good at that. Hence, you know, you can see that by the fact that he hadn't even thrown an interception this year. So just going to be a big game on Sunday. Really looking forward
really
to it.
Really is. And I would have to think that, you know, the big thing is trying to establish the run, which, of course, they do reasonably well. But, of course, one of the strengths of the defense, even though the Ravens don't have a good pass rush, is the strength that they have is pretty much being able to stop the run.
Yeah, and they blitz. I mean, that's not a good recipe against Russell Wilson. So points galore, I think, on Sunday. I hope, anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, and of course, I mean, one final thought here is look, the Astros are on the verge of clinching the American League and setting up a series going up against the Nationals.
Yeah, it was sad to see CeCe Sabathia go out yesterday. Not particularly well. The Yankees had, I think, four errors. They left 13 on base, were 0-for-7 with runners in scoring position. They're down 3-1, and they're relying on an ex-Mariner to keep their season alive.
Yeah,
good
James
luck.
Paxton.
Good luck, Big Maple. But, it looks like the Astros, I mean, it would be, it's not unprecedented, but what a surprise it would be if the Yankees were able to win three straight here. I mean, it's always possible, but, boy, does it feel unlikely after last night's game.
Yeah, but also just, I mean, I think the idea is going to be, Justin Verlander out there. I think you'll see him at his best.
Well, we haven't seen anything less than that, have we, in this postseason?
No, that's true. So far, so good. Hey, and of course, Dave, I hope you have a great weekend. I know it's going to be enjoyable, so thank you. And I'll be back tomorrow from 8 to 9 taking your phone calls, and Monday at 10 o'clock, it's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.